From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Salt, fat, acid, heat. The simple formula for the fundamentals of great cooking, and also the title of Samin Nosrat's James Beard Award-winning cookbook, and also of her Netflix series. Nosrat is everything we need from a high-profile food celebrity right now, meaning she's the opposite of everything we've come to expect. Yes, she is trained at one of the best restaurants in the U.S., but she doesn't own a restaurant herself now, and she's not a New York or L.A.-based male figurehead of haute cuisine, idolized in luminous slow-mo cantilevered over a pristine plate ministering to microgreens with a tweezer. No, Samin Nosrat is the approachable master, your brilliant friend who puts fine food within reach while also introducing you to the unknown people who've been doing exactly that all along. So this hour on Point, a conversation with Samin Nosrat on food, fundamentals, and changing the face of cooking shows. And you can join us. Have you read Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat or seen the Netflix show? How has Samin Nosrat changed the way you cook and the flavors you experiment with it? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Samin Nosrat joins us today from New York. As I mentioned, she is a chef, writer, and food columnist for the New York Times Magazine, and her debut cookbook, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, won numerous cooking awards, including the James Beard General Cookbook Award for 2018. Samin Nosrat, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Meghna.
It is such a thrill to have you, let me say. If I may, I just want you to give you one measure of how successful your cookbook and show have been. Because I was re-watching sections of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat on Netflix last night with a particular young person in my house. And she said to me at the end of the third episode, she said, "Mom, what's her name again? That lady, that chef. I really like her. I want to make some of this stuff."
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Yeah. You know, that was my goal with the show, was there are so many other food shows that exist for so many other reasons, and I just wanted this one to make people want to cook.
Yeah.
And that it is reaching kids makes me even happier.
I have now promised to make buttermilk chicken, just so you know.
You have to.
I'm absolutely going to do it. Okay, so you have reached people in a very powerful way. I mean, your cookbook was your debut cookbook. It won all these awards, numerous fans across the United States. But Samin, I wonder if you could just start by telling us the wonderful story about how it is that somebody who never necessarily grew up thinking, "I'm going to be a chef," you know, or a major food figure in the United States, in college ended up working at one of the most iconic restaurants in the United States.
A lot of serendipity, for sure. So my family's from Iran, and I grew up in Southern California eating delicious home-cooked Persian food. And, you know, the occasional taco or Chinese food or pizza. But in my family, we didn't go out to eat in fancy restaurants. And I don't even think at the time there were any particularly fancy restaurants in San Diego. And so when I moved to Berkeley during my freshman orientation, one of the things that we were told was that there was this famous restaurant in town. But that sort of just like went in one ear and out the other, since it wasn't really relevant to my life and it wasn't the kind of place that my parents would take me when they came to visit. And so I didn't really pay that much attention. And then the next year I fell in love, and my boyfriend was from San Francisco, mm-hmm. from the Bay Area. So we spent a lot of our time eating together and going to his favorite childhood places. And he had always wanted to go to this place, Chez Panisse. And I still didn't really know much about it. I learned that it had a famous chef and it had been around for a long time. But I was excited to save up money. So we saved up $220.
I love that.
We had this like shoebox that we put coins in and stuff. And so the morning of the dinner.
It's not for partying. It's to go to Chez Panisse.
Totally.
I love that. Okay.
Very Berkeley. So the morning of the dinner, we took this shoebox to the bank and we exchanged it for like $200 bills and $220 and a $20. And we went to dinner there. And the restaurant has a fixed menu. So I had never been anywhere like that before, where you just go in and you're served what they're making that night. And so we had this dinner, and it was so enchanting and wonderful in this place. And, you know, my mom is an extraordinary cook, and I was no stranger to good food. But I think for me, what really really got me that night was just the way I felt cared for. It felt like eating in someone's house where they've taken care of every detail. So the minute, you know, we finished the butter, they would refill the bread and butter. The minute we, you know, my water ran out, they would refill the water. And there was just this way where we felt so attended to. And the dessert was a chocolate souffle. And I had never had that before. I'd never had souffle. So when the server brought it, she said, would you like me to show you how to eat it? And I was like, probably, you know, we were radiating, I think, youth and inexperience. I was wearing a denim skirt and a black tank top. And so I said, please show me. And so she said, well, you have to poke a hole in it with your spoon and you pour the sauce in. And that way every bite has sauce. So I did that. And she said, how is it? And I said, oh, it's really good, but I think it would be even better if I had a glass of cold milk, because it was this like warm chocolatey thing. And, you know, you want to eat your warm chocolate brownie or your chocolate chip cookie with a glass of cold milk. And she sort of laughed and she was like, you want milk? And I said, yes. And so she brought me a glass of milk, and she also brought me dessert wine, you know, to teach us the refined accompaniment. And what I didn't know at the time was that in sort of fine dining, it's considered like milk is only for babies. And so as if – I mean, it's not like they didn't know that we had never been in a fancy restaurant before, but I really was giving it away when I asked for the milk. And so I was so moved by this experience, and I always had jobs throughout college. And so I decided to write a letter asking for a job just bussing tables.
Yeah.
So I wrote this letter and I brought it in with my resume, and they said, oh, you have to bring that to the floor manager. So they brought me to her office. And when she opened the door, it was the souffle lady. And so she remembered me and I remembered her. And, you know, in retrospect, I think she was probably pretty desperate, because she was like, can you start tomorrow? So I started bussing tables. And within a month, I was just begging them to teach me how to cook, because it was so enchanting and just it was something I really wanted to be a part of.
Well, so then you get back into the kitchen at Chez Panisse. I mean, again, just an iconic place in the story of American food. But there's something that you talk about that you witnessed in that kitchen that just spoke to my heart so profoundly, that not only, you know, you had this experience being cared for in the restaurant as a guest, but then in the kitchen, you saw excellence at work. And that how that was one of the things that just that, I mean, that was the moment that you said, perhaps this is the world for me.
Yeah, I think from the first minute, and honestly, in that institution, which by that time had been around for 28 years already and was like fully humming at full clip, every bit of the restaurant was exuded excellence, not only the kitchen. So even as a busser, when they taught me how to take out the trash, there was a proper way to tie the bag and put it in the trash dumpster. So everything had its place, and really the height of it was in the kitchen. And there was just a way where people were somehow simultaneously so relaxed and just – it was like watching a ballet. It was so beautiful, yet I knew there was so much hard work behind that. But there was never stress sort of coming out of anywhere that I could see anyway at that point. And it was just – it was the most beautiful thing. And then every day we sat down to these incredible meals. You know, after work we had family meal, and it just – everything tasted so good. And I just – I knew I was in the presence of people who were doing extraordinary work and extraordinary things. Yeah. And the longer I worked there, I learned that this was not the most typical kitchen.
Well, so how is it then that you came to – I mean, I know it was a process, but how did you come to this realization that, by the way, that these four fundamentals – salt, fat, acid, heat – are really at the core of balancing them, is at the core of what makes for great food. Now, for people who have dedicated their life to fine cuisine, you might be telling them, hey, did you know the sky is blue? Because of course it is. But for the rest of us, it felt like a revelation. So, I mean, how did you come to this sort of beautiful encapsulation of these four fundamentals?
Well, for me, it was a revelation too, because when I, you know, expressed interest that I wanted to work in the kitchen, they said, okay, well, you need to go read these books. You need to study every day at home. You need to cook. You need to come to work when you're bussing tables and pay attention. You have to start volunteering in the kitchen. And every day at that restaurant, the menu changes. And sometimes they're cooking food with the flavors of, you know, France or Italy or Spain. And sometimes there's Moroccan flavors or Indian flavors. And so I just was a person who knew nothing. And I was in the company of these people who seemed to know everything. And they never looked at cookbooks. They never looked at recipes. And so there didn't seem to be a link between what I had been told to do at home and in reading these books and what was happening in the restaurant. So I had what I felt was a constant headache for about 2 years while I was just, you know, I didn't know the difference between parsley and cilantro. Like, I didn't know anything. So I was really just sort of, what's the word? It was a sink or swim situation. And over time, as I started to see, there were certain things that we did every day, whether we were making French food or Indian food. And it always had to do with these four elements. We always salted our food. You know, the meat, we salted it the day before so that the salt had time to travel and really penetrate the meat from within. And with fat, there was this way that in the pastry kitchen, they were always so careful to use cold butter when they were making their flaky doughs. But on the savory side, we had to heat our pan to put olive oil in so that it was hot and we could get a crisp exterior. Mm. And with acid, it was this thing where we were tasting. And every time people would be like, I think this needs a little squeeze of lemon, or in kitchens, it's often called brightness. This needs a little brightness. And heat for me was the biggest revelation, because even the ovens there were so well worn that the dials had no – you couldn't really read the numbers on them. So people would just like wave their arm in front of the oven to figure out, you know, how hot it was, to guess where to cook their stuff. So there was this way where there was such mastery. It really eventually occurred to me that these were the four elements.
Well, we're going to take a quick break here, Samin, and come back and talk a lot more about not only what's in the book, but your Netflix series as well. We're talking this hour with Samin Nosrat. She's the James Beard Award-winning writer behind Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking. Same name of her Netflix series as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're lucky enough this hour to be talking with Samin Nosrat. She's the writer and chef behind Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking. It's her debut cookbook that she won a James Beard Award for last year, and also the title of her Netflix series as well. Samin, the comments are already coming in online. D. Kieft says, Samin is my new idol. I've always loved to cook, but I was getting bored. She's given people permission to have fun again and experiment without having to be perfect. And Todd Freeman here says on Facebook, Todd says, do not watch the show before bed. You will wake up with an empty refrigerator. And Todd, this is exactly, well, a part of this is what happened to me last night, because I was watching the show again last night. And at like midnight when I wrapped up, I stood in front of my fridge. I was so hungry. All I had, though, Samin, was some like goat's milk yogurt, which I loved because it had that acidy tang. But I was like, mm-hmm. What should I add to it? And I settled with maple syrup. I'm not sure if that was the right thing to do.
I was about to say honey, so that's great.
Okay, well, speaking of honey, I want to play a clip from the Netflix series Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, from the acid episode, actually, which I love, where you travel to Mexico. And in this scene, specifically to the Yucatan, where you visit this remarkable family of beekeepers that maintain the ancient tradition of Mayan honeymaking. So let's listen.
You grow up your whole life thinking honey is one thing, but there's actually so much more to it.
Yeah.
Do you want?
Okay, yes, please.
This one is Cephalotrigona sexmania. The color is very similar.
These. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my gosh. I was not expecting. Oh, my gosh. It's hard to believe there's not a lemon in there. It's almost like honey lemonade or something. It's so acidic. I've never tasted honey like this.
Samin Nosrat in the episode Acid. I loved that. Can you tell us more about this honey and this family as well?
Yes. So these are the Melipona honeybees. They're a stingerless variety of bee. And this culture, this village, these people – so traditionally beekeeping was left for the women to do. And these specific bees, because they don't have stingers, they have had to develop almost a symbiotic relationship with their humans to help protect them from predators. And so there's this really – but all, throughout the years, you know, throughout the millennia really, they have developed a mythological place in this culture. And there's so much sort of reverence given to these bees. And it's really extraordinary because their honey both is this incredible acidic, you know, thing that is unlike any honey I've ever tasted, but also it has these medicinal qualities and these healing qualities. And it's very precious because they produce about 1/30th the amount of honey as a typical honeybee.
Right. I mean, you're just pulling some of the honey out with a syringe.
Tiny syringe. Yeah. And so it was just, it was really, really extraordinary for me to get to travel there and meet them and to learn about this tradition. It really, it blew my mind. Honestly.
So this is one of the hallmarks of the show that I wanted to explore with you, because I've read that you went out of your way, and maybe your producers didn't necessarily need the encouragement, but you asked them, go find the people, you know, the abuelas, etc., who we've never seen on TV before, but who are making these fundamentals, these great foods. Why was that important to you?
Well, for me, I think I mean, I don't know how else to say it other than I want to give credit where credit is due. And looking back at human history, since, you know, in general, it's stated that humans have been cooking for 10,000 years since the beginning of agriculture, essentially. And since that time, in almost every culture of the world, women have been doing the cooking. And yet when restaurants came along about 300 years ago, it really shifted to this place. Restaurant kitchens became a place for men because all of a sudden there was money and glory and attention and fame involved. And so for, you know, 9,700 years, it's been women's work. And the minute that there was any sort of, you know, outside attention, it became the space for men. And that really has rubbed me the wrong way, especially as a woman in professional kitchens who has felt, you know, has just witnessed a lot of exclusion of women and people beyond sort of typical sort of white men. And so I felt like there I might not ever have another opportunity to make a show or to speak to such a large audience. And I wanted to make sure that we made a show that that told stories of the people who don't typically get their stories told and honored them and honored their work and their stories.
Yeah. Well, let's talk to some of the people who you have reached with your book and the show. Let's go to the phone. Let's go to Gina, who's calling from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Gina, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to share with Samin our family story that we have all been gathering around the TV, which is very unique because the children are always distracted with other things these days. But your show has brought, I have four kids in here, and they have all really enjoyed watching. Especially, I wanted to share my 9-year-old who has become very aware of those four elements. We were grocery shopping yesterday, and he said, Mom, is that acid? Is that the ingredient? So I just wanted to share that you're reaching a young audience. And
you're bursting my heart.
Oh, great. Hopefully he's the next generation cook that's going to become aware. And just to understand that it comes from the people, my grandmother is who I learned from. And so I really appreciate you going to those communities and sharing where the origins of the food is coming from. So thank you.
Well, Gina, this is incredible. Thank you.
Yeah, Gina, thank you for your call. And, you know, Samin, something that Gina said, it got me thinking. You know, we were talking about the excellence that you saw in Chez Panisse a little earlier. But when you really think about it, virtually everyone who rises in the ranks of the food world will point to someone in their own lives, whether it's a mother or a grandmother or somebody who, in their own form of excellence in the kitchen, was the most profound influence in their lives.
So, absolutely,
you know, like we ought to be recognizing that more often.
Absolutely, and you know, one thing I always think about is the minute I started cooking, they told me you won't know anything, you know, until your body really knows this, and it becomes a second sense, and that takes 10 years. And this was sort of before the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours thing, where the idea of mastery comes after 10,000 hours of practice, but But once I took a minute to think about it, I was like, well, who do you think has the most practice? It's grandmas and moms who've been cooking every day for decades. It's these people who are the most masterful and yet very rarely get the honor and the attention. So I think it's amazing, you know, anytime anyone looks back and honors the people who came before.
I'm thinking of the grandmother you talked to again in the acid episode, who handmade, 200 to 250 corn tortillas every day.
Oh, yeah. Extraordinary. Extraordinary. In her sleep, she could have done it.
Well, let's go back to the phone. Let's go to Kylie, who's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Kylie, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to thank Samin because I grew up, well, I was born in the States and then I grew up in Afghanistan and Turkey and Switzerland, and I learned to cook, and a lot of my identity was shaped by those variety of cultural flavors, and it's hard for me to find them in my daily life here in Charleston, South Carolina, but watching your show, you just make the combination of flavors and culture so like common sense that it's really refreshing, and it really kind of made me feel happy that someone else, and I'm sure a lot of other people, also understand that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Well, so Samin, though, talk to me a little bit more. Talk to us a little bit more about, you know, Kylie's getting at the cultural identity that comes with food. You talked about your mom growing up. How central of a role did Iranian and Persian food play in your growing up in San Diego?
I think for my mom, you know, probably she couldn't have articulated it this way, but looking back, I think for her to cook for me and my two brothers was probably the anchor, the cultural anchor of our family life, and a way, a really important and powerful way for her to introduce us to our Persian culture. And it was also really delicious and enjoyable. And so I feel really grateful because it's certainly the part of the culture that I feel the closest to and have the deepest relationship to. And it's for me become this way where I always thought that it was something unique to our family, that people would come over and taste our food and say, wow, this tastes just like Iran, you know, and remembering something wonderful. And then as I grew up and went out into the world and met other people and other immigrant children of immigrants and met other immigrants, I realized that everyone is sort of always searching for that taste of home. Mm-hmm. And so it's become almost a language for me and this way for me to relate to people. You know, every time I'll even get in a cab, and I'll say, oh, where are you from, you know, to the driver. And then they'll say something. And if I know something about that place's food, we'll start talking about it. Otherwise, I'll say, like, what's your favorite food that your mom used to make you? And it's just this incredible door into people's lives and a way to have a relationship with them.
You are speaking my stories in here.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I just – like I remember actually even to this day just – the joy that I would see on my mother and father's face when, you know, my mom obviously was the chief cook in our house, and that just when she would just make even the simplest foods, like a dal, like a really good dal, because she got a really good lentil from some Indian store that had popped up like 100 miles away growing up in Oregon. But just the recognition of the authenticity of that flavor is something that I can still see, you know, and feel in my very own heart. And how did that sort of experience of food and culture inside your home, though, Samin, compare to what you were experiencing outside the home growing up? Because you've told stories about, you know, being called a terrorist in the second grade.
Yeah, I definitely was one of very few kids who wasn't white growing up in my school and in my community. And so on the one hand, I was never ashamed of the food, and I was really stoked always to take my mom was so creative too in the food that she would pack for me and my brothers, and she would make Persian pasta is just this very funny sort of bastardization of like Italian ragu sauce. And she would then pack the leftover spaghetti in a pita pocket. So I had these spaghetti sandwiches that I loved. And she would make me sandwiches with kuku sabzi, which is like our frittata. This is very bright green. and kids were, you know, it smelled different and it looked different and they would make fun of me. But I was like, no, 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 this tastes good. But I also still wanted to participate in what everyone else had. And so I remember I had this friend probably in third grade who was – she was like stick thin and her mom was, I think, just trying to fatten her up. So she'd have like peanut butter and jelly sandwiches on Wonder Bread, but there was always a layer of margarine in there too. And then her mom would give her like bags of Oreos and stuff. And for whatever reason, she didn't like Oreos, but all I ever wanted was an Oreo. And so every day she'd throw her Ziploc bag of Oreos in this one bush. And I was like, I never got the courage to dive in the bush and look for the bags of Oreos. But I was like, you gotta stop throwing them away. Like, give them to me. So I was basically non-discriminatory. I just wanted to participate in all of the food.
Ding dongs were my thing growing up.
Oh, yeah, yeah. She had ding dongs too. I just remembered that. Yeah, she liked those though.
All right, so I want to. Oh, you've been talking about your mom a lot, and she is in the last episode, the Heat episode of the Netflix series, and you cook with her. You cook a classic Iranian rice dish. So let's just listen to a little bit of that.
You want a little piece of tajik, Mom?
Yes, but just a little bit from the corner.
I like it too.
The saffron is so fragrant.
Bring back all times.
It's so good, Mom. It's been a long time since I had this.
That's from the Heat episode of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. Samin, when I saw the amount of saffron you put in there, my mouth started watering immediately. But it looked amazing. But one thing I wanted to ask you about it is that scene is as close as we get to Iran itself, you know, through your mother. Because I have read that when Netflix greenlighted this series, you wanted to do the acid episode in Iran, but ended up not doing it because you had some particular concerns. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, we were about to go, actually. We were just days from going. So we were ready to go. And then there was sort of like a political shift that caused the State Department to recommend that we didn't go. And for me, I don't really feel personally any safety concerns, but there were people who, you know, I loved my crew so, so, so much, and they gave everything they had. And many of my crew members were parents or for example, our director of photography, his wife was pregnant. And so they were nervous because of, you know, what they have heard from the media and the world. And there's a way that I learned, and I knew this in other work that I had done, but on the show I learned that if we didn't all feel safe and protected, there was no way that we could make the most beautiful thing and be our most full creative selves. Mm. And so when we got the news that that sort of the State Department had revoked their recommendation, I didn't want to push us to go do something because I knew everyone wouldn't feel safe.
Yeah.
And it was so important to me, and it continues to be so important to me to tell the story, to tell a story about Iran that has never been told before and shared in a way that's never been shared with the West, at least in my lifetime. And
I'm sorry to interrupt here, but didn't you also have a concern that you weren't sure at that time if you wanted American audiences to see you with a headscarf.
Oh, in a hijab?
Yeah, speaking Farsi.
You know, I don't think that wasn't the reason we didn't go.
Okay.
It was just that was not at all the reason we didn't go. It was more just that occurred to me at various points. What kind of attention that might bring upon me. But I actually have to say I'm pretty proud of the fact that I speak a bunch of different languages. I in a way, I was a little bit bummed that I didn't get to go speak this other language on TV. But I look forward to to having the opportunity to do it in the future. Yeah. And I'm confident that we will. But yeah, of course, those are things that have occurred to me over the years is that I don't look like everyone else, and there can be a negative attention that comes with that.
Yeah. You know, we've got about 30 seconds before we have to take another break here, but you were talking about telling a story of Iran that hasn't been told very often. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking there was one episode that Anthony Bourdain did Tehran, which I thought was terrific because
it was fantastic.
It was doing exactly that. It was showing us a side of this nation that Americans literally never see.
Mm-hmm. And I watched that multiple times before we went in it to research and to sort of fill out my idea of what it was that we could do when we went there.
Well, Samin Nosrat, stand by here for just a moment. We've got to take a quick break. We are talking to the James Beard Award-winning author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, and also the star of the Netflix series by the same name. What's your question for Samin on the fundamentals of great food? This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Samin Nosrat. She's author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, and star of the Netflix series of the same name. And Samin, again, wow, this is like mountain of fan mail or social media coming in. Nicole Eigbrett says, I love how Samin is shifting the narrative on who can be the expert in the culinary world. You're an inspiration. Thank you. And Susan Dorr says, I think the most valuable part of the series especially is the deep reverence for indigenous foodways and traditions. And on that note, I want to play another scene from the Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat series. This is from the fat episode, Samin, where you are in Italy and you visit the makers of a red cow parmesan, and you're given the opportunity to taste differently aged cheeses.
Okay, so you've brought me everything for tasting.
Yes.
So we have the 2 years, 24 months,
yeah,
at least,
mm-hmm,
30 months.
Yeah.
40 months.
Yes.
Okay, can you tell me a little bit about how to taste?
Mm-hmm.
What am I tasting for?
You have to start from the youngest aging. So you have to begin with 24.
Okay.
When you taste the first aging, you taste the milk.
Okay. It's sweet. And mi sembra dolce.
Yeah.
It's rich in flavor.
Yeah.
It's so good. It's so good. It's bringing tears to my eyes. It's so good.
It brought a tear to your eye. I don't say that in disbelief. Like, I was like having a reverie as I was watching you eat that.
I'm almost crying now. Just remembering.
What was so good about it?
I think for me, it was really overwhelming to stand there in that place and to understand all of the work and tradition that went into that one bite of cheese that I was taking. And I, for the length of my whole culinary career, I think Parmesan is the ingredient that I have the most reverence for, just because so much goes into it. So to stand there in that room and with these people who've devoted their lives and for generations have devoted their lives, that was very overwhelming. And then it also just tasted so amazing. One of the most amazing things about Parmesan is that it's the rare food that hits every single taste bud in your mouth. Mm-hmm. And we have five different kinds of tastes that our taste buds are after. And Parmesan hits every single one, sweet and salty and sour and bitter and umami. And it's like fireworks going off in your mouth.
Well, let's go back to the phone. Let's go to Joe, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Joe, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi, Joe.
Hey,
go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to actually share a little story. My my girlfriend, she's a food systems researcher, and she really wanted your book about 2 years ago, right when it came out. So, and I was planning to propose, and I had whittled a ring out of wood from her family's land, and I was going to put it into the book, and I needed to find, it's such a beautifully done book. There aren't a lot of spaces where I can find 60 pages to drill a hole. So I think it was in around 178, I found 60 pages where I could just drill a hole and not ruin any of the beautiful art. And I gave her the book, and she was flipping through, and she was so grateful. And then I said, well, she hadn't found it. I said, well, check out the balsamic vinegar recipe. And she said, why? I think maybe page 178 or something. So she flipped it and found it. But we're married
now.
Oh, my
God. This is amazing. I need to come meet you guys.
Yeah.
And
you should.
Wendy McNaughton, the illustrator who worked on the book, will be, and also our designer, will just be so grateful that you didn't ruin the art.
Oh, and it was really hard. It took me a few hours to find the pages I could use and not ruin any of the art or the margin comments. It was tough, but I found it.
Thank you
right
for being so conscientious.
Joe, first of all, congratulations. I'm so glad that it worked. And thank you so much for your call. Let's go to James, who's calling from Massillon, Ohio. James, you're on the air.
Hi. I only have a couple of comments real quick, or actually one comment, one question. First, I'm visually impaired, and so I'm 44, and I've just learning how to cook. And my roommate watched your show, and this was the one thing that he helped me use to figure out how to cook with flavors and stuff without even really knowing what I'm doing. And my question is out of those four things, which one would you start at? Like which one? Heat, salt, fat, which one would you start at? I'll get off the phone so I can hear the response. Thank you.
Oh, what a wonderful question. Thank you so much for calling in and for your comment. First of all, I don't even think visual impairment is necessarily an impairment in the kitchen because I think it actually makes your other senses forces them to be stronger and more sensitive. And I think of cooking as a completely sensory experience. So I hope that you don't think of it as an impediment, and I'm really excited for you on this journey. And in answer to your question, I think the most important place to start is with salt, because if you can get your salt right in your food, you can make anything taste like 85% better than it did before. So that comes – and the great thing about salt is it's not even so much about seeing it. It's about feeling it in your hands and feeling how much you're putting on, and then more importantly, tasting it and stopping and tasting everything as you go many, many times so that you can develop a palate and develop a sensitivity for what the right amount of salt is.
And so for folks who don't have much more than just table salt at home right now, what's the next kind of salt you'd suggest that they buy?
Yeah, there's a type of salt called diamond crystal kosher salt. It comes in a red box. And the thing about salt is all salts are different salinities. You know, they come in different saltiness. And so it's something that a lot of people don't know, because recipes might just call for a teaspoon of salt. Mm-hmm. But a teaspoon of, let's say, table salt, the stuff that comes in like the blue canister, that's about two or three times as salty as a teaspoon of kosher salt. So it's why I'm so insistent in getting to know your own salt and tasting it. But the reason I love that diamond crystal kosher salt is because it's very light and flaky. You can use a lot of it without making your food too salty. And because it's in these rolled flakes, when you season a chicken or steaks or vegetables, it sticks because it has a greater surface area rather than bouncing off.
Right. And so therefore all the scenes of you taking enormous handfuls of salt and pouring it all over everything.
They're contextualized a little bit.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I was just going to say, because do you think people generally don't add enough salt to when they're cooking?
I think most home cooks don't use enough because we, you know, and understandably, like as a society, we have really high blood pressure and there is a lot of salt in our food. But in general, that salt is in processed foods. And so if you are just using the right amount of salt in your home cooking and eating more home cooking rather than, you know, chips and fries and stuff out, then you're going to consume less salt on the whole. Plus, most of the places where I'm doing the dramatic hand gesture of adding a handful of salt is into like a pot of water,
right,
where you boil your vegetables, they absorb some salt, and then you throw away 99% of the salt down the drain. So it's just about creating an environment of saltiness to get your food seasoned to the right point.
All right, let's go to Piero, who's calling from Springfield, Illinois. Piero, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. First off, thank you so much for writing your book. I loved it so much. It really, and some comments and a quick question at the end, of course. The comments I want to say is that it really shed light on kind of my own heritage, even though my family's from Peru. I'm a first generation American, and I was born here when my mom was on a work visa. And that eventually brought over a lot of my family, including my granddad, who was our chef for the family, and ended up having a couple of restaurants in New Jersey. And then after he passed, I didn't really get a lot of culinary education besides the one that my palate had gotten and just growing up. And my mom was never really amazing cook, but she got better actually as necessity came up. And now after reading your book, it was like, oh, it was so great being able to kind of get a full vision of why certain things taste the way they do and why I like certain things. And I've been working in kitchens my whole life since then. And yeah, just thank you so much. And I was just wondering if we should expect something else or anything like that.
Yes. Your fans want more, Samin.
So I am going to write another book, like much to my own dismay. Just because it took so much energy, but I am pretty excited. It's going to be about teaching people how to decide what to cook.
Uh-huh.
So that I'm pretty excited to do. And there definitely will be more shows. We just haven't exactly figured out what they're going to look like and when they're coming. But from what I understand, people are impatient. So we're going to try and do something as fast as possible.
Do you think the what to cook question has become even more complicated in the internet age? Because sometimes I find myself like I don't even particularly feel inspired, and then when I start looking online, I'm just overwhelmed with like the 57,000 recipes to make, you know, a simple tomato sauce.
I think it's really – yes. And I think the internet has been both a curse and a blessing for home cooks because it's inspiring and exciting. But then also you can get very overwhelmed or even intimidated. And so I think in the same way that I tried really hard to explain how to think about, you know, what to cook or how to cook, I would like to explain how it is that professionals decide what to cook. And I think there is a pretty simple sort of formula behind it. And once you understand that, you can make better decisions for yourself and your family.
All right. I will pre-order the book now, not even knowing what its title is going to be. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi. The show makes me a little bit sad. Because I'm Greek, my mother came from a little island in 1935 and brought such treasures to this country. By 1955, I was putting ketchup all over my food in school because the food was so bland compared to what I was eating at home. An interesting thing, second generation, we began losing the cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
And the third generation, which means mom's grandkids, finally we start to lose family solidity in this country. And with that, the cuisine starts to collapse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very sad. It really is.
Jim, can I just jump in here for a second? I'm so sorry to interrupt you, Jim, but I completely understand what you're saying and how you feel, because just in my own family, I live 3,000 miles away from my parents now. But for a while, I was on this mission to try it. My mom's our family chef, and she...
Yeah.
You know, she has all those recipes in her head that have been passed down through our family for generations. And I was trying to get her to write them all down. And I'm a little worried that I won't get them all down before, you know, it's too late. So I completely hear about losing that.
Yes. Yes.
So Samin, I mean, what do you think? Do we, as generations upon generations pass, that is that loss there, the threat real?
I mean, I think that the loss is absolutely – the threat of it is really real. But one of the beautiful things now is that we all have these phones that can do so much. And so I think for me, even in my own family, there are sometimes like, you know, relationship challenges. But that's one of the beautiful things about food is that my mom's – she knows so much and my grandmother knows so much. So I can just – you know, call them and I can record information and I can go there and take videos and, you know, even just record audio and try to capture and remember this stuff. And in terms of what you said, the recipes all being in your mom's head, I actually just wrote a column last week about my friend Rishikesh and his family's from central India. And he was trying to get a recipe out of his mom. And she said, "We're Indian. We don't measure anything."
That is absolutely true. And my mom's probably listening to this. Hi, Mom. I love you. But she always tells me, like, she'll hold her thumb next to her, like, middle knuckle and say, "Well, if you want to add, like, garam masala, it's about this much." And I'm like,
"Yeah, totally.
How much is two knuckles? My knuckles are bigger than yours, Mom." And she's like, no, it's this much. There's an intuitive sense to it, which I'm not sure I've mastered yet. So I want to ask you another quick question, Samin, to turn back to the show specifically here, because one of the things that I think people have been so drawn to is that the show was produced with the same production values as we see with, you know, like the Chef's Tables programs. Like, it is very carefully attended to.
Yes.
So it's in this zone where you're making the food accessible, but you're treating with this visual reverence. And I wanted you to tell us why doing it that way was important to you.
Oh, that was so important to me. And I think – I don't even think I could have imagined this show before I had seen Chef's Table, because before Chef's Table, I'm not sure that I had seen a show that food had ever been treated with such sort of a cinematic quality. And it really started getting me thinking when I was watching Chef's Table about what I wasn't seeing. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of planted in my mind. And the other thing with my work, with my book and everything I put out in the world, you know, and this goes, I owe a great debt to Chez Panisse for this, is that I have a commitment to creating things that are very aesthetically pleasing and beautiful. I believe that that's a big part of an experience, whether it's picking up a book that's beautifully illustrated or watching the show or a plate of food. But in general, you know, the beautiful things tend to be reserved, or like the quote unquote beautiful things tend to be reserved for, you know, the wealthy people,
right,
or the like elite arts. And so it was very important for me to exist at that intersection of accessibility and beauty. And I didn't think that only, you know, accessible shows had to always be in studios with like classic lighting, that they could be filmed with beautiful lenses and in this really respectful way. And I'm so glad that, you know, the people who worked on this show really were committed to that as well, including our director and our cinematographer, who just wanted to make something very, very gorgeous.
And you did it perfectly, I think, because there's the performative aspect of food that comes with Chef's Table isn't there. There's an authenticity, but again, that visual reverence.
Oh yeah, we had a joke, no classical music. Yeah. And no slow motion. Those are our two jokes.
No slow-mo. Absolutely.
<Yeah. laughs>
Well, Samin Nosrat, chef, writer, and food columnist for the New York Times Magazine and author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking. It has been such a great pleasure to speak with you. Samin, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. What a great pleasure, Magna. Thank you.
You're most welcome. And folks, go to our website, onpointradio.org. We've got some recipes from Samin there. Again, that's onpointradio.org. And by the way, before we wrap up, I want to let everyone know that in March, we're going to be running a special series every Monday on a theme we're calling Where We Call Home. And we're looking for your stories or questions about affordable housing, home ownership, small town living, and more. So if you go to our website, onpointradio.org, we've got a survey there where you can share your experience with things such as working from home or the rising cost of living, or whether you actually know your neighbors. So that survey, and we'd love for you to take it, is at onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.